What's that I hear you say? You want off-the-cuff conversations with professionals from theatre and film, talking about how they got into the industry, giving advice to the next generation? Well, you've come to the right place. Welcome back to the Ad-Libbing Podcast.
This is episode 3 and our guest is Roy Alexander Wise, the Artistic Director of the Manchester Royal Exchange. Roy is a real inspirational speaker and he ad-libbed with us about the first time he went into a theatre.
Which was a very relieving experience.
Winning the JMK Award in 2014 and why theatres should represent all members of society.
Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, Roy Alexander Wise, and thank you for coming to Ad Lib with us today.
Hello.
How you doing?
Yeah, you know, as best as you can do in a global pandemic, I think.
Yeah.
Just keeping my mind in a good place, or trying to at least.
When we came up with the podcast and we like started thinking of names of who we'd really like to speak to, yours was one of the first names that came up, and I messaged you straight away and you said yes, and we were very excited. We know Roy, we all trained together at Rose Bruford College, and Roy was on the director's course, which is something a little bit different to anybody else we've spoke to. So first question, I guess, is what sparked your interest in directing specifically? Because you made that choice quite early. You were already training in that field when we met you.
So, I think when I started the course, I kind of had it in mind to continue acting and writing as well. But I don't know, lots of factors kind of like changed that for me. One of those actually was like seeing how amazing all of you guys were on your journey and going like, oh, okay, if you want to do that, you've got to really commit yourself to that. So I just thought I'll stick to directing. I'm doing all right at it. But I don't know. When I was younger in youth theatre, I had an amazing youth theatre leader called Nikolai Labarry, who is an extraordinary artist. Like he was so much more than just like a tutor or facilitator. He was like a father to many slightly broken and lost young people. And one day he just kind of, he said, I think there was like an opportunity to make a project with a few companies who were doing like this kind of nationwide youth leadership scheme. And he was like, oh, do you want to do this thing? You and Zephyrin can put together a company and like do what you want, basically. And he was just sure that I could be a good director. And so, you know, with the arrogance of youth, you just kind of go, yeah, okay, I could do that. And it was really hard, actually, but I really enjoyed it. And I think also something that he saw before from all the acting that I did with him is that, like, even if I wasn't on the call for rehearsals, I was always in there and I always had something to say and I was always watching everything. I think I've always been obsessed with watching actors work. Yeah, it kind of just made sense when I started doing it, but I realized that it was the one thing that I needed the most training in. So that's why I went for the directing course. But also the year before that, I had applied for a bunch of acting courses.
Don't worry, so had I.
And so the story goes. And so yeah, part of it was a bit of rejection, but also I kind of discovered that, like, as a director, I could, like, all of the ambition that I had of being, like, really involved in the process as an actor, I could be a part of that in, like, I could be a part of all of those things as a director. Whereas, like, when I was an actor, I was like, oh, you should play this song. at this moment, and the director's like, shut up.
Sorry, that's not your role.
So like, actually, it's like, you need to find your own room where you can do that yourself, and then you can call those shots. So I didn't really imagine that that was the journey that I would take. And also, I guess partially, I had to go to university. Like, my parents weren't afforded that opportunity. Also, I grew up in a really particular circumstance. Like, my grandma, from the age of 16, my grandma became my sole carer because my mum had passed away, and I know my dad, but we didn't have an amazing relationship. And I think my grandma felt exceptional pressure to make sure then that all of my mum's children did really, really well. So she really pushed us. And I was like, I'm not going to go to university. And she was like, if you're going to live in this house, you're going to go to university. So, you know how our accreditation was from the University of Manchester?
Yes.
I told my grandma that I was at the University of Manchester and that I was studying English literature.
Wow. So you didn't tell her you were at Rosebery for doing directing?
No. My older brother and sister knew it became something that became clear to her. She's not stupid, obviously. And there's only so long you can keep up a lie for. And she came to Rose Bruford for my graduation with my brothers and with my brother and my sisters. And we've never spoken about it.
That's incredible.
You know, she was really proud at our graduation. She was like making, it was a very like civilized and British affair. And she was, I remember in the top balcony of the Rose Theatre, like making noise, and I was really embarrassed because, there weren't that many black families there. And it's like, why? Why? We already stand out. Just calm down. I think over time, I've been able to explain it to her, and she kind of gets it. And my family get it a bit more. So, but a degree, I had to get a degree essentially. And that really is the thing that propelled me to do an actual BA, because I don't know what I would have done otherwise.
Yeah. So you say your family get it now, what you do, directing and stuff. Does that imply that your family sort of theatre was not something that was part of your family growing up? Was it, when did you come to theatre and when did you discover it in your life?
No, it wasn't. Like, I mean, my family are like, I don't know, ordinary immigrant family who are like, do whatever you have to do to make ends meet and to survive and to give the generation after you something better. Like, I thought that I was going to go into music. That was always something that I had like a real passion for. And I was really lucky to like play some instruments at school. I remember I got a trombone. I joined the cadet band, the army cadets band. They gave me a trombone and the school didn't see that trombone again. Because I was like, oh my God, I've got an instrument. I think it might actually still be at my mum's house.
I can't tell you how similar everything you're saying is to me as well, though, because I've got it was the same at school. I was offered to play an instrument, so I played the clarinet, and I remember I found a clarinet in a cupboard somewhere, and nobody, not at school, it was somewhere else, and nobody knew who the clarinet belonged to, and I was like, well, can I have it then? So I nicked this clarinet as well, so that's what I've got. And we are the first generation in my family that have gone to university as well, and I grew up with my mum and my grandma, and like everything you're saying is so similar to my background, just coming from a working class family in Newcastle. So I guess there's probably a lot of people out there that can relate to what you're saying. Me very specifically. Just a slightly different wind instrument.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so music was the thing that I was really into. And I think like it still really inspires a lot of the work that I make and how I make work as well. But yeah, I thought that I was going to go into music. I thought I was going to be a singer and maybe a songwriter. I guess, I walked into Oval House Theatre by accident on the way home from school. I went to a school called Archbishop Tennyson's in Oval. And like on the bend on the way round to where I lived, there was this building I'd never been in. I didn't really know what it was. And I went in to use the toilet and then discovered it was a theatre and saw that they had like a table tennis thing and they had like other young people that went there as well. So like me and a couple of other friends from school, we just decided to go there and we started hanging out there and we were a bit of a nuisance. And I think they, like, I don't know, they just started coaxing us into taking some of the classes. So initially I did some of the singing and music classes, a bit of music production and stuff. And then I got asked to be in a play called Chat Room by Enda Walsh.
I was in that.
You were in it. Who did you play?
The girl who says, "Brittany, you have ruined my childhood dreams."
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. That's her name. Yeah, no, I remember what you're talking about. I can't remember her name. But yes, whoa. Yeah, this is really weird, Natalie.
I know.
But that was like essentially the first play that I'd been in that I was like, oh, plays are dope. Like plays can be really amazing. And also, I mean, that was kind of around the same time that my mum died and, you know, had all of this stuff kind of going on that I didn't really know how to deal with. And strangely enough, I think Nikolai, who was running the youth theatre at the time, I think he knew that this play would really mean something to me. And I hadn't really acted. And he cast me as Jim in the lead role. And I used to go up to him after every rehearsal going, "I think you might have made a mistake. Maybe give the part to somebody else." But he made me stick with it and really supported me through that time. And there was just something like incredibly therapeutic and cathartic about saying the last lines of the play and having this moment where this character could release all of this trauma that had lived inside of him as a child growing up and the relationship with his mother and his father and all of this and his siblings and just release it into the ether and somehow he was purged and clean and could like figure out a way to move into adulthood. So it was really in line with everything that I needed. And I think that's when I really discovered what the power of theatre was.
You have had quite a career since Rose Bruford, and a lot of people have had some incredible experiences because you chose to be a director. Do you want to talk, anybody who's listening that doesn't know Roy's career? I mean, Roy Alexander Wise MBE, isn't it? Very coy. I mean, you must have done something right. You might not have got that if you had have done your writing course at Manchester.
I mean, I technically, yeah, exactly.
So
I haven't actually collected it, you know. It was cancelled because Lizzie and Phil obviously don't want the virus to get into their house. So
doesn't matter.
I mean, they're not even there.
You've got your letters.
So
it's like if I do a role and I filmed it and then it doesn't end up in the final edit, still put it on my CV.
Yeah, of course you do. Yeah. What was your question?
What was the question? No, sorry, I just got really excited by MBE. It's so exciting.
Really weird.
So the first half was, basically talk us through kind of what happened for you from leaving Rose Bruford to where you are now.
Right. So in the third year, we had to do a placement at a theatre. The only theatre that I really knew about was Oval House. And even at Rose Bruford, I didn't really go and see many plays. I don't think I actually read any of the theory books that we were supposed to read. I bought them. I didn't, I don't know. The academic side was really...
But I can relate to that because Because when you're training at a drama school, it's very all-encompassing, isn't it? And it's very
intense.
And you're in lessons and you're learning for many, many hours a day. Sometimes on the weekend, the last thing you want to do is to travel into London and go and sit in the theatre for 3 hours and watch a show with all of your peers. You know, I needed that headspace away from it.
Yeah, yeah. Education was always, like, I'd always did okay academically, actually, like, but I think it was the first time that I was in an arena where I felt really out of my depth. There were lots of things in terms of, like, my identity, who I am, being a young black working class man from Brixton and stepping into Rose Bruford and being in, like, you know, I had never understood before that point that I was supposedly an ethnic minority. And suddenly I was plunged into an experience where that was really, really evident. So there were all sorts of things that were really challenging about that. But also what it did to me psychologically is made me feel slightly disenfranchised from the institution of education. So I felt like there was something inherently... There was like an inherent disconnect because everything that everyone kind of understood or behaved as if they understood was what was normal in terms of like learning and education felt so alien to me. So I just decided that I was allergic to books and decided that I couldn't read. I decided that I would never understand what I was reading in books. Like, you know, in the first year, I spent the entire first year and I was such a chatterbox when I was younger. I spent like all 5 years of secondary school on report because I was always like arguing with teachers. I'm not saying it because I'm proud of it, but just to give a sense of like how distinct my behavior was from like, you know, leaving college to starting drama school. I completely changed as a person because I felt so out of place and so disconnected from what I felt like there was a contract that everyone had signed and I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe everyone felt like that to some degree, but people were better at hiding it than others. And I guess I felt so out of place that, like, you know, I'd spend an entire week and I would sit in class and not say a word. Like, I would, unless I was asked to speak, I wouldn't say anything. Even if I had questions, I would never volunteer anything. There was a point even in first year where for 2 weeks, I just stopped coming in because I decided that it wasn't right for me. It was really, really challenging. And so I guess when I got back into the swing of things and tried to really take on the challenge, and it was like Mathieu Bellon, he was really instrumental. Oh no, I hope Colin Elwood doesn't hear this. Colin was great too. But Mathieu said some stuff to me and because he was never afraid to have like the race conversation with me.
Yeah.
It meant that there was somebody who wasn't black that I could maybe talk about these things to and who would get it. I remember Ollie actually, who was in my class, he became another person that I could really have those frank conversations with. And he really got it, you know, like, and I can't tell you how amazing it was to, and it was when we were doing Lulu, Natalie, which you were.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you and Ollie were our assistant directors.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was when we were doing that suddenly, like, I was able to kind of express some of that stuff. So really, second year was when I started to get into a groove. And also I had done a little, like little bits of work here and there that I'd got really amazing feedback for. So I was like, oh, okay. So the books I am crap at, and that is fine. I can be crap at the books. And actually, I'm not coming here to leave with some kind of intellectual degree. I don't even care what mark I get. I want to learn how to make work.
If it wasn't for you, I think we would have had a whole cast of actors that like really like maybe might not have went on stage. Because can you remember? I don't know if Mattie planned it, but he did this really dramatic director thing, which this isn't your style at all. But he kind of sat down and just said that we were all doing really badly and we needed to up our games. And he like walked out of the room and we were all kind of like, I don't know if we were chatting or something. We had annoyed him somehow and he just went and he didn't come back.
That was his style.
You just stepped up and became the lead director and we all just put our faith in Roy. We didn't know what to do.
That's so weird. I don't even remember that.
A bunch of actors without a director about to go on stage. It was horrendous. We were all like, we were all in a flap and you really just stood up really calmly and just got us all through it.
Oh, wow.
These guys that were in the cast talk about that quite a lot. I wasn't in that particular show. And I remember, you coming off stage being like, Matthew's like disowned the show.
Wow.
Like 5 minutes before we went on stage, you just disowned us all. And Roy and Ollie had to step up. But how interesting that you don't even recall that taking place. But that obviously had a massive impact on Nat and some of the cast and the way that you stood up and led that and sort of saved that moment.
Wow.
Maybe he did know what he was doing.
I was going to say, in hindsight, I think it might have been like...
He was a really, really clever man. Like, I think about, there are some things that he did, you know, there were... And I think one of those things, and no disrespect, I think he's an incredible artist. And there are like really like small fundamental... Not small, they're huge actually. There are like fundamentals of directing that he said... that I carry with me everywhere, you know, like, but there, you know, anyone that has worked with him knows that he knows how to leave a room, you know, he knows how to like, like make an exit, you know.
Hello, it's Ali here. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. I wanted to take a moment to let you know about my other podcast, The 7 Song Setlist. Here's my co-presenter and best friend, Daniel Kemp.
Hello.
Kemps, what's our podcast, 7 Song Setlist, all about?
So 7 Song Setlist is where we take our favourite artists and favourite bands. If they were playing a show and they can only play 7 songs, what would be that perfect setlist? And that's what we debate on this podcast.
We'll be compiling 7 song setlists together on loads of the bands and artists that would have been headlining this summer's music festivals. So if you're missing gigging and live music as much as we are, then look out for us on social media, 7 Song Setlist, and keep an eye out later this month, wherever you get your podcasts, for the 7 song set list.
That was perfect.
Woohoo!
One of the things that became really important was like basically connecting with other people that might have been having a similar experience to me. So I became quite close with Ola Ince, who was in the year above me on the directing course. And she was doing her placement at the Young Vic. And she just like raved about how amazing it was. And I checked out the director's network and all of that. And went and saw some stuff at the Young Vic that I really loved as well. And it was like, you know, 20-minute walk from my house in London. So I was like, this is my new theatre. So I was like, I'm going to do a placement there. So I did a placement at the Young Vic at the end of third year. And literally by the end of my placement, they were like, so there's this other project that we're doing, working with this amazing director called Mia T.L. Havi, and working with a group of refugees who were living in East Ham. So we did this amazing project where we made an adaptation of A Nightingale, which like a Hans Christian Andersen like story. And then I was kind of like, oh my God, like we're doing this work that is more than just making plays. We're doing work that is also like activism. Like it really showed me the kind of civic responsibility that we have as theatre makers as well. I assisted at Talawa. I assisted Michael Buffong at Talawa with a co-production at the Almeida, which was really amazing. And then I kind of got to know lots of other people, and through the director's network, you got to see lots of opportunities that were happening around the country. And I met Madni Yunus. No, before then I met this amazing man called Topher Campbell, who I'd actually met when I was much younger, who was kind of supporting with the initial project that Nikolai had put me on, where we could make our own piece of work, which was before I went to Rose Bruford. And actually the first like kind of full-time-ish job that I had was assisting Topher at his company called The Red Room. And part of that was doing a bit of producing and assisting him. I assisted him on some like telly stuff that he did as well, which was really amazing. And then he kind of handed me on to Michael Buffon, who then like handed me over to Madani Yunus, who had just taken over the Bush at the time. And Madani was just incredible, because it was at a point in my career when I was like, I think I'm going to have to bow out, because, you know, I was seeing lots of amazing stuff happening from like even graduates from Bruford who were just putting on their own work. And I was like, I don't know where to start. The idea of putting on my own show, like paying people, getting the money to pay people. It was just so difficult. And I was working like every possible job. I did cleaning for a while. I was like working as a bartender for years. I was doing the world of everything that I could do to like make it possible to keep doing it. And Madani just kind of like was really amazing at going like, okay, you need to work out a plan. And then he put me onto this BBC Theatre Fellowship, which was a joint application with the Lyric Theatre. And it was actually the first, that was when I met Bryony Shanahan, who I now run the Royal Exchange with. Because she was on a similar thing for the Royal Exchange under Sarah Frankham in like 2013 or something. So I had this amazing experience working for the Bush and the Lyric and developing my own kind of voice and developing my confidence, learning about, you know, how I might go about getting some work on. And then Madani wrote to Vicky Featherstone, and then I got to know Vicky and assisted on an amazing play called Liberian Girl at the Royal Court with Matthew Dunster, and at the same time applied for the job as trainee director, and had the most magical meeting with Vicky and Hamish Peary, who's the associate director there, and then got the job as trainee director. I was like, you know, I used to walk past the Royal Court going, oh my God, I wish I could work there one day. And like, I feel like I spent 2 years almost there, just every time coming out of Sloane Square Station, looking at the building going, I can't believe I work here.
Can you remember when we saw you in the, you were doing your notes with a cast or something, and we were just in the bar and we were like, look at him. Because the Royal Court is one of those places where like when you see somebody you know who's working there, you're like, eee, they're in the Royal Court.
It was crazy. And, you know, it was working with like, you know, it was like Nikolai and then Tofa and then Michael Buffon and then Madani and then Vicky and all of these people, you know, and I'm sure there are people like there was a woman called Shabnam Shabazz who was like incredible and so instrumental. All of these people that helped me to develop my voice as an artist and like kind of like facilitated in my kind of political awakening, which I guess eventually is the thing that has led to me making the work that I make that like essentially is like what I want to see, which is like a story about someone like me that essentially is not a story that has some kind of hidden agenda of trying to like show an audience that is not black that they are like acceptable, that their behaviors and ways of life and cultural specificities, that those things are like, so it's not a piece of work that is explaining it. It's just like, this is you, just like every other human being in the world. This is you, this is your experience.
We talked about that with Kirsty actually, how that's what theatre is to us. We want to see ourselves reflected on stage. We want to tell stories on stage, you know, that reflect our society. And yeah, it's not TIE.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. But I think that, like, you know, when you come from when you live in an experience that is marginalized, I guess, like, you know, for some women, the idea that they've got to write and explain the like human condition for women, like what that experience is. When you're black, you've got to explain stuff. When you're disabled, you've got to explain that, rather than just being able to be characters who actually in your life, you just are, you just be, you just do. And the beauty of like telling stories as they actually are, that's where real learning happens. That's where, you know, I tell the story of me growing up and you, Natalie, go, that's exactly the life I've had. And you from Newcastle, white working class woman from Newcastle, and me, like young black man from Brixton, we go, oh my God, we literally have had almost identical like experiences.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just started doing that and got really lucky. Like an amazing playwright friend called Eve Lee, she basically fought for me to have my first production, which was at the Finborough Theatre. Whilst I was doing that, I had also applied for the JMK Award, and it was actually the third time I had applied for the award. And at the time that I was making Stoneface, I won the JMK Award, which enabled me to direct a play called The Mountaintop at the Young Vic. It was the first time really that I could tell a story that I could completely own, and that was like about something that lived right in the pit of my being.
And what was that story? What's The Mountaintop all about, if anyone isn't familiar with it?
So it's like a fictional account of the eve of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and this like ridiculously beautiful maid comes to basically seduce him. He thinks that she's a spy because he's really anxious about everything that's happening. It was the night that he made the speech called The Mountaintop, which is where he says that I'm okay with dying. Like it's one of those things that was like really weird and mysterious about his death. Yeah, it was this story essentially about how this woman who was like foul-mouthed, whiskey drinking, cigarette smoking, like sassy woman came into his room. And her job basically was to undo him as a human being, to unravel him as a human being. Being a woman who essentially you figure out at the end that she actually was an angel sent by God, who was actually a black woman, as in God. and so she basically was sent by God to basically say to Martin Luther King, you need to figure out a way to hand your notes on to someone else, because tomorrow you're going. Like, tomorrow is the end. And then she takes out a cigarette and just blows it. She just blows the cigarette and it lights up. We actually did it as well. It was...
Really?
Yeah, it was amazing. It's just, it was this play that was about the reality of like, read it. Honestly, if you haven't read it, it's one of the most incredible plays. It's laugh out loud funny. Like, I wept by the end of it. When I read that play, I wept. I was like, I have to do this play. But yeah, it's like, you know, entrenched in the really brutal reality of the experience of African-American people at that time. But then at the end of it, before she leaves him for the night, he starts asking all these questions like, what is the future going to be like? Will anybody actually continue this work? And it's the most heartbreaking thing to see someone like Martin Luther King worrying about the future of the world and the planet and going, is anyone going to do this? And then she's like, I'll take you to see the mountaintop. And she kisses him and he faints. And then she recites this poem that is essentially the journey from the moment of his death right through until Obama's inauguration.
Because of the noughties passed on.
And between each stanza, she says, the baton passes on, the baton passes on. And we did this amazing thing with the actress where she, the whole thing was on this like platform in the center of the space. And she came off into the audience and started walking, and it's and you realize that she is part of running that race. As she's running around, her body is being physically manipulated by all of these events and projected around her, be it behind her, everywhere, all of these images of these things happening. So the audience experienced this assault of like civil rights history that happens in like 2 minutes. It's like bam, 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 bam throughout. And then it ends and Dr. King sees it and he's like, oh my God, this is so beautiful. But what we have actually seen is like, you know, the last images are like Obama and then like a kid holding a Black Lives Matter sign. And then you see Hillary Clinton come scroll on and then Donald Trump stroll and you're like, oh my God. And it was at the time.
It was just, cause this was 2016 you did this production, wasn't it? So it was possibly just months before Trump got into office and would have been exactly, around the Brexit yeah. referendum and stuff. So
yeah.
Which was a very scary time for everybody.
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds electric.
It was amazing.
It reminds production. Me a bit of Briar Cotton.
Oh, yeah. Briar Cotton.
And that was your production in, that was 2 years ago, 2018, right? At the Theatre 503, was it 2018?
Yes, it was 2018, yeah.
Don't tell me it was 2017, because I still remember it really well and having a drink with you and Michael, who played in the bar after, and it certainly doesn't feel like 3 years ago. I'm getting worried like how quickly time is going, the older I get.
You used the imagery in that as well. The projections worked really nicely in that.
Yeah. It was like that play was a mad play because it was set in... It was set in a kitchen that was sinking into a cotton field. So we're like, we're at Theatre 503. There's no substage. There's no, how the hell are we going to do this? So,
hey, the design was incredible.
Yeah, Jemima Robinson. She is like one of our nation's greatest, like, and she's like still, you know, like not as known, but she's incredible. She's such a brilliant artist. And yeah, it was like, yeah, it was such an incredible journey making that play. Yeah, that was, yeah, I loved making that show. And that was just before
Nine Night.
I directed Nine Night. Yeah, so the press night for Brer Cotton was the first day of rehearsals for Nine Night. It was like,
And that was your first, the first time you directed at the National.
Yeah.
Quite a big one. The Nash.
Crazy. Like after leaving drama school, it was like 7.5 years of assisting. So I hadn't, other than like the odd scratch that you get to do here or there, I hadn't directed my own stuff, which was really tricky and really terrifying, but kind of in a way showed me that like the assisting route, like I did learn a huge amount from watching other people work. Hi, I'm Roy Alexander Weiss, and you're listening to the Adlibbing Podcast. If you're enjoying these chats, don't forget to like at Adlibbing Pod on Twitter and Instagram and subscribe for more off-the-cuff conversations.
Some of the stories that you told about that time of sort of making those connections with all of the people that you worked with at the various theatres that you assisted at, and the story of the refugees in East Ham that you made the show with back in, well, like 2000, and what would that be, 2011, 2012? I can't remember what you said. But it seems like a lot of those experiences, coupled with your own personal experiences of growing up in London and stuff, sort of have really shaped and molded the work that you produce, right? The idea of absolutely. Identity and for me, community as well. It's important, isn't it, to see, you know, people's identities, people's communities represented on stage, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. Like, and I think, I don't know, if I'm really honest, I've watched some stuff that people have said is great and gone, I literally do not understand what is happening here. and because of that, I was like, is everyone just lying? Is everyone being fake? Or maybe I just don't have the cultural reservoir and maybe that's okay. But maybe what I need to do is start making work that is really representative of my cultural reservoir in the hope that maybe there are other people that have experienced that as well. And lo and behold, it's like people are like, oh my God, I have never seen something that has felt so honestly reflective of my experience. And I just gave myself the provocation all the time, like, would grandma get this? Like, if what I'm making now, would she understand it? If she came in and watched this, would she get it? And like, actually, the most terrifying night ever for me is when my family come and watch my work.
I love that.
And they don't have the language to say it was excellent or whatever, like other people do. They're like, yeah, it was really good. Or, yeah, I really like that. Or, yeah, it was all right. But it's like, ah! Sometimes it's like really frustrating. But like, you know, actually, you want to make work for ordinary people to experience it and appreciate it. And they do, you know, and they did. And they just don't necessarily have the same vocabulary and language as all of us who spend our entire lives watching and critiquing and making work.
And that's a really important point to make, because it raises the question, why do we need the language in the first place?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, essentially what we're doing is we're telling stories, and it doesn't matter, like, for me, like, whether the audience can articulate how it moved them.
Mm.
What's important is that it did move them or it did show them something, you know?
Yeah.
We've had loads of conversations about theatre and the audiences that theatre attracts, because, you know, sometimes people feel that they're making work for people, but they're finding it hard to get the people that they want to see it into a theatre. And do we need to change the way that we think about theatre etiquette and stuff like that? And I love having those conversations about how you expect a theatre audience to behave when you're on stage and stuff like that. Those are really interesting conversations.
I've got some mad little anecdotes as well, actually, about those very particular things. So when we were doing Nine Night, you know, Natasha Gordon, the writer, she'd written the most incredible play that was coming from a real truth that she understood. Like, there were lots of conversations that we had with people that were like, you know, this black play that, and she was, you know, it's a British story. It's a story about British people. Mm-hmm. It's a story about a British family who are experiencing grief, and they deal with all of the other crap that everyone else deals with when dealing with a family in a moment of crisis. That's what it is.
Yeah.
But it suddenly was like really revolutionary to see a British Jamaican family on stage. I was like, there is no way that there's no way that this play will work at the National if we don't make sure that there are British Jamaican people and other people that will kind of recognize this experience. It won't sing. You know, we had like massive conversations where, you know, I just said to Rufus, like, it will not work if the National cannot put the resource into like building relationships with the communities that need to watch this piece, then it will not work. We have to. So we had like codes going out everywhere. I think there was something about the title as well, because like, if you are Jamaican, or if you're like, for most black people, they know what a Nine Night is. So it was all about how we connect with those audiences that might not have ever been here. And it was electric. Like, you know, I remember in previews, people came in to the theater with food, like hot food, or like people would be talking and like talking about what is happening, as if like it was kind of like Gogglebox a little bit, or like watching, like, do you know what I mean? And there were some audience members who were like, shh, and people were like, who are you talking to?
Yeah, I'm not at the LSO.
Or like, you know, there was this moment where one of the characters is like trying to butter his sister up to ask to make this big ask, and she's cleaning chicken, and he's like, oh, let me help you. And then he takes the bag of chicken and he's like, he doesn't know how to put his hand in it. So there's this whole comic moment where he's trying to figure out how he's going to attack this chicken. And this woman in the audience went, you're not going to wash your hand. And the room erupted. It was wild. And that was when we knew that we were on to something, that like we had made something that was really going to going to allow people to feel a sense of familiarity and ease in a theatre that I think, if I'm honest, a lot of other white audiences really take that for granted. People don't realise how revolutionary it is to be able to see and hear some of those voices. It's why Barbershop Chronicles was like such a massive thing, to see that many variety of black man in sharing a space. You just go like, people don't realize, like, for other people, what that is, what that actually means. It's huge. And what they do psychologically for individuals, the way in which they teach us that we can navigate this world, like, it can't be taken lightly. It's huge. It is huge, you know? So, anyway.
I love talking to you, Roy, because anybody who knows me, like, I could spend a whole rehearsal process just having conversations like this. My youth theatre was live theatre. You probably know live theatre.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that started with Tim Healy and Val McLean and people like that. They would go into social clubs. So they would take theatre around social, work in men's clubs. And that was kind of how the theatre started. And it's still set up in that way now, live theatre. They still have the cabaret seating at the front with all the, like, the tables.
Yeah.
And they've kept that format to this day. And we've done a play. We do lots of plays actually that are written by young people. They work in the community loads, live theatre, and I love it. And we've had families that have come in with their picnics and put them on the table. And absolutely, we encourage it because, like, that's how the theatre began.
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't need to change and become something that it doesn't need to change from kind of what it was born out of. We can keep all of those elements, and it's incredible. And if you're halfway through a dramatic moment and somebody opens their sandwich, fabulous.
Like, it's all part of the experience. Or you could have just watched the film at home, you know. You have to be okay to be in that space with other people. And, you know, we had it when the show transferred to the West End, we had it at Trafalgar as well, you know. There were like groups of like elderly groups of women from their churches or whatever that would come. And whenever there were moments in it where hymns were being sung, they would join in with the hymns. And you'd see people in the back row standing up, looking down, going, oh my God, what is happening? It was the most electric thing ever.
I think that's what theatre in the whole industry that we're in is all about, is social inclusion. In fact, it's what I did my dissertation on at Rose Bruford, how we can use theatre to increase social inclusion. And I think that'll be what it is about for me forever, really.
And kind of interesting that, you know, listening to the audience reactions and what you and your production created, that buzz and that excitement, that electricity in those audiences, and that feeling of accessibility and safety in a place that otherwise might not feel like that, to me goes all the way back to the very first story you told us at the beginning of this podcast, the first time you walked into a theatre to use the toilet, and the first thing you noticed, it seems, or the way you tell the story, was that there was a table tennis table in there.
Yeah.
You didn't notice the classes necessarily or the theatres. The first thing you noticed was there was a table tennis table set up.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, cool, this is a cool place to come and hang out. And you got into it through it. So just that feeling of, or that knowing that there is something there for you.
Completely, yeah. I think theatres, you know, it's only during this time, during this pandemic, especially while Bryony and I are really thinking about what our theatre has to be for the city of Manchester and the region of Greater Manchester, it's only during this time that I think I've been able to find a way to articulate it like this. But theatres are essentially, and theatre buildings, they are an extension of like democracy. You know, the way in which other institutions have like the really rigid means and bureaucracy that we understand and connect with democracy, like theatres are an extension of that. Theatres are the other places where we try and unravel the other stuff between us as human beings that we don't quite get, that we can't quite put on paper. That's what I think theatres are.
And do you know what? I had so many more questions that I wanted to ask you, but that's such a beautiful image. I think we should end the podcast with that because, yeah, you've just, like, in my head, I've just walked out of a theatre and it's one of those ones where you just can't speak for half an hour. And I'm just thinking, yeah, you've nailed it. That is what theatre is all about for me.
Yeah. I was just thinking how exciting it is that you and Bryony are, you know, running the Manchester Royal Exchange and the power with which you speak about theatre and the importance that it could have within our society is just thrilling. So
exciting.
Thank you.
I know it's been a bit of a rocky start to your tenure here at the Royal Exchange. You probably weren't expecting to be talking to us, but I hope you're back up and running at some point soon. And
I hope so too.
And that your vision, that idea of, you know, bringing that what you mean to a community and what you mean to the people of Manchester and the city of Manchester can be realised, because it sounds so exciting, mate.
Thank you. I really hope. Yeah, if you don't laugh, you'll cry, innit?
Thanks again to the wonderful Roy for ad-libbing with us. That interview took place on the 22nd of May, which is just 3 days before the brutal killing of George Floyd by 4 police officers in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
In response to recent events, The Mountaintop will be streamed for free on the Royal Exchange's YouTube channel on Wednesday the 10th of June at 7:30 and will be available until Monday the 15th of June. The new digital reading of this important play will raise funds to support the legal costs incurred by those incarcerated while protesting.
Before we go, we would like to ask you to do something for us, something we haven't asked of you so far in our podcast journey. That's to leave us a review.
Unless you hated it, then just don't tell anyone.